Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Donald Trump laid out his foreign policy yesterday in Youngstown, Ohio. For Trump, the battle of our time is the fight against radical Islamist movements. He said we need extreme measures to test immigrants for loyalty and even vicious efforts to uproot terrorist networks. Clinton, Hillary Clinton, is spending less time detailing her foreign policy, instead asking voters, do you trust Trump? This hour on Point, how the two candidates would lead America in the world. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Did you listen to Donald Trump's foreign policy speech yesterday? At least catch a couple of sound bites. Who has a better sense of the state of the world, of the right way forward? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In the fight against ISIS, Trump said he would push hard for a broad international effort with allies and others, including Russia, to destroy what he described as a common enemy.
My administration will aggressively pursue joint and coalition military operations to crush and destroy ISIS, international cooperation to cut off their funding, expanded intelligence sharing, and cyber warfare to disrupt and disable their propaganda and recruiting.
Let's look at the Trump push, the Trump way, and hold it up as far as we can with the Clinton way. Joining me now from Washington is Nihal Holly Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Holly, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
With us from Washington as well, Karen Osman, Washington correspondent for the German news magazine show Spiegel TV. Karen, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And last but not least, from Weston, Vermont, via Skype, is David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be back with you. Greetings from Vermont.
David, what do you see in the worldview of Donald Trump expressed in his foreign policy outline delivered yesterday?
Well, Tom, I got a little bit less of a sense of his worldview from the speech yesterday than we got from those two lengthy interviews that my colleague Maggie Haberman and I did with Mr. Trump on his foreign policy views, both in late March and then again at the convention in Cleveland last month. In those, we sort of surveyed the world and his approaches to NATO, to the Asian allies, and all that. This speech was all about countering terrorism and basically immigration. And what it told you was that his view of the way to go deal with this is to go back to an approach that George W. Bush attempted in the days after the 9/11 attacks. And hard to imagine that's 13 years ago. And we've learned a lot since then about how you counter extremism, and we've made a lot of mistakes in the interim since. But basically, at that time, President Bush took a view that we would measure our allies entirely by the degree to which they participated in countering terrorism. And so he went to China, and the only thing he wanted to talk to the Chinese were about was terrorism. And he went to Russia, and the only thing he wanted to talk to the Russians about was terrorism. And what happened? Both the Chinese and the Russians used this approach as an excuse to go suppress their own Muslim minorities, sometimes quite viciously. And we quickly found that there were moments where our other interests in the world, say China's activities in the South China Sea or Russia's activities in the Baltics threatening former Soviet states, we had to get into this balancing act because those were not factored in to the foreign policy. And I think what President Obama has done is moved us back to much more of a balance. And what you've seen from Mr. Trump is an explanation about why he doesn't think that balance works. But, you know, just this morning, what did we wake up to? News that the Russians, for the first time, have put air assets in Iran to go do their attacks in Syria to support Bashar al-Assad. So there's a complication because during the course of the speech, Mr. Trump said that the Iranians would be our distinct enemies, as as a state that fosters terrorism, and that we could be deep friends with the Russians. Well, world's a complicated place.
Donald Trump painted a world that had grown darker during the time of President Obama and the time he was had to decide Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He said, let's look back at the Middle East before, he said, the Obama-Clinton administration took over.
Libya was stable. Syria was under control. Egypt was ruled by a secular president and an ally of the United States. Iraq was experiencing a reduction in violence. The group that would become what we now call ISIS was close to being extinguished. Iran was being choked off by economic sanctions.
Holly Toosey with Politico in Washington. How about Donald Trump's characterization of the world before Obama, and for that matter, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton?
Well, on the surface, it would seem like he has a point. There was more stability then. This was before the Arab Spring and any number of other things happened. But it's also important to remember that many of these places, such as Libya, et cetera, were also very repressive. And there were tensions and fissures that would probably eventually have come to light, no matter what happened. At the same time, he is making a point that the Obama administration's withdrawal of troops from Iraq did leave a type of security vacuum there, and that allowed for ISIS to expand, et cetera. So these things, it's a complicated case that he's making, but if you ask a lot of the people in the Middle East, they'll say, well, you know, life is terrible now, but it wasn't exactly perfect back then either.
Karen Osman, give us a sense of how this looks perhaps from Europe and Obama's balance, as David Sanger puts it, what that's achieved and whether a more muscular, maybe much more, I mean, he uses the word extreme often, even vicious, Trump approach, how that would look to Europe, which after all has borne the brunt of the refugee exodus from the Middle East.
Well, I think that there's a consensus, at least in Germany, that Donald Trump is not a candidate of choice for Germans, that's for sure. Obama's politics have been perceived by many as more balanced than George Bush's politics, but in a way also isolationist. So one could argue that President Obama could have actually contributed a little more positively to what Donald Trump now calls the refugee crisis in Europe. Instead, a lot of Europeans feel kind of left alone, which does not mean that they consider Donald Trump's proposed politics to be a viable alternative. Just a little while ago, the German foreign minister, Steinmeier, called Donald Trump a hate preacher. Angela Merkel, when asked about Hillary Clinton and how she would get along with her, she referred to her very diplomatically as somebody who's very experienced, somebody that she could work with very well and that she has worked with very well. When asked about Donald Trump, she just dryly answered, I don't know very much about him. I think people know a lot more about him now, but they're not really seeing him as a viable alternative.
He compared Hillary Clinton to Angela Merkel himself yesterday, and not favorably, but he also looked a lot at the home front, thinking about foreign policy. On immigration, David, extreme vetting of immigrants to the United States. What does that suggest to you? Does that suggest for all immigrants from all parts of the world? Is this an extension of his first Muslim ban and then potential ban on immigrants from nations that have been hit by terror? What does extreme vetting suggest?
Well, there were two parts to this, Tom, as you suggest. So the first part was that he said that Hillary Clinton was becoming the Angela Merkel of America. So he was, usually when Angela Merkel is referred to by American politicians, both Republicans and Democrats, it's pretty favorable. I mean, she was certainly President Obama's favorite European leader, or has been, but also did pretty well during her early days and her rise in German politics with the Republicans as well. And he meant this as she's somebody who's allowing, said at one point she would allow up to 1 million Syrians to come into Germany. Something that's proven to be politically extraordinarily difficult for her now that they've had so many troubles with the Syrian immigrants. So he was painting Hillary Clinton as basically following the same strategy. She's not. Hillary Clinton's proposal is for about 65,000 Syrians to come in, which is a tiny fraction of, say, what the United States brought in from the boat people after Vietnam. But the second part was the part about extreme vetting. He didn't say what that meant. He had initially said that we would ban Muslims. Now he has changed that to a geographic test with something of a loyalty test. He said it was all about whether they could support the Constitution and our diversity and our values. That's a very difficult thing to figure out from interviews with immigrants who are coming in.
Holly Tusi, do you see a repetition in the works here if Trump were to become president, of previous eras in which America has, to a great extent, closed its borders to immigration?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the Cold War and before then, there were times when the U.S. Had ideological tests of sorts, communism, et cetera. These things were considered when allowing people in and out, not to mention race-based types of exclusions, et cetera. Although, my understanding is that religion has not been something that's been used as criteria in the past. Some scholars will tell me that technically speaking, though, you could, in theory, use religion, and it probably might not be unconstitutional because foreigners don't necessarily have First Amendment rights. Of course, it would seem to very much violate the spirit of the First Amendment. And it's one of those things that some people would say they'd be eager to test in front of today's Supreme Court versus the rulings of past Supreme Courts from, a far different era. I have to admit, though, it was very striking, some of the things he was suggesting for this ideology test, et cetera. When he says something like bigotry and hatred and American values, it's very confusing what exactly that's going to mean. So, for instance, he talked about the Islamic State's hatred of gay people. And the question is, well, does he want people who come here to favor gay rights? And many people in his own coalition don't necessarily favor gay rights. It's a very, very interesting thing, and I'd love to see more details from him.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on American foreign policy. One of them will likely guide our way in the world come next year and a new inauguration. David Sanger joins us this hour, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Nahal Holly Tusi is with us, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. And Karen Osman is here. She's Washington correspondent for the German news magazine show Spiegel TV. You can join us as well this hour. What did you hear in the Trump approach yesterday? What about Hillary Clinton and her view of the world? How would you describe the Clinton way in foreign policy, the Trump way, if you can make it out at this point? Donald Trump called yesterday in Youngstown, Ohio, for weeding out terror support networks in the United States, viciously, if necessary, he said. And he called for strict new loyalty tests for immigrants coming into this country.
In the Cold War, we had an ideological screening test. The time is overdue to develop a new screening test for the threats we face today. I call it extreme vetting. I call it extreme vetting.
And out in the world, maybe some steps that others would consider extreme as well. In his speech yesterday, Trump said he has long said that the U.S., during the Iraq War, should have claimed Iraq's oil wealth after fighting a war he says he was against. Quote, if they had listened to me, he said, we'd be in much better shape.
In the old days, when we won a war, to the victor belonged the spoils. Instead, all we got from Iraq and our adventures in the Middle East was death, destruction, and tremendous financial loss.
Holly Tusi with Politico. To be fair, I well recall in advance of the Iraq War, the Bush administration suggesting that somehow oil flow or oil wealth would be part of the payoff for intervention there. But what is Donald Trump suggesting here that we should have, that maybe might still go in and just take oil fields?
Yes, that's a good point. But the thing is, you know, what the Bush administration was suggesting was a far cry from what Trump is saying, which is basically that we should just say we can have their oil and just take it. I don't think Donald Trump necessarily knows the history of how U.S. or foreign claims on oil in the Middle East have been a source of tension for the people there. It harkens back to decades ago. Everything from the Iranian Revolution and other tensions have stemmed from this idea of foreign intervention and involvement. So this idea that the U.S. could go and take this natural resource that in theory should be a source of tremendous wealth for the people of that particular country, I just don't think that that is something that will fly for the people there.
Donald Trump is holding up cooperation and going after terrorism as the main litmus test for U.S. allies yesterday. And then going hard, he said, very hard at ISIS. Here was Hillary Clinton. Let's listen to her take. This was the Democratic Convention laying out her plan to prevail in what she described as a long fight against ISIS.
I've laid out my strategy for defeating ISIS. We will strike their sanctuaries from the air and support local forces taking them out on the ground. We will surge our intelligence so we detect and prevent attacks before they happen. We will disrupt their efforts online to reach and radicalize young people in our country. It won't be easy or quick, but make no mistake, we will prevail.
And here was Secretary Clinton in Scranton, Pennsylvania yesterday, talking just before Trump laid out his foreign policy, mocking his claim that he doesn't want to explain certain plans because they might help the enemy. Here's her sort of pre-buttal of the Trump speech.
We'll wait and see what he says today. But, you know, sometimes he says he won't tell anyone what he'll do because he wants to keep his plan, quote, secret. And then it turns out the secret is he has no plan.
David Sanger, did we hear everything yesterday? And if you had to put the Clinton approach to ISIS side by side with the Trump approach, as far as we can understand it, how would you describe the difference?
Well, it's hard to see a huge amount of difference because we haven't gotten tremendous amount of detail from either one of them. And as Secretary Clinton was saying facetiously there, you know, one of the elements of the Trump strategy is to say, we're not going to tell you in advance what we're going to do, which is what the military would tell them. Yeah. The fact of the matter is that so many years into this fight, the military, the intelligence community have built up a vast set of knowledge about what works and what doesn't work. That doesn't mean that they've got it right now, because this is an evolving adversary. And ISIS obviously was a huge intelligence failure because it came up in ways that people hadn't detected and ended up taking a lot of territory before people knew really what was going on. That said, a lot of what the specifics that you heard from Mr. Trump yesterday sounded a lot like what President Obama is doing now. A few months ago, they announced they're using cyber weapons for the first time against ISIS. They didn't say exactly how, so it was not to tip off ISIS or how they're doing it. What Mr. Trump said was that he would shut down all communications. Well, that sounds appealing, but the first thing the intelligence people will tell you is that when you shut down communications, you lose track of people that they are tracking. So sometimes they want to keep those communications lines open because their adversary doesn't know that they're being followed and somebody's listening in about their planning or who they're planning with. So shutting things down doesn't often is rejected by the intelligence and military community. The second element is the air power part, which Secretary Clinton talked about. Then you heard Secretary Clinton say that she would work with the allies to put their forces on the ground that we would advise. You didn't hear that from Mr. Trump. And it was unclear from what he said whether what he envisioned was American forces on the ground, which would be politically, I think, a bit difficult, or whether he envisioned training and then putting out Iraqi and other Arab forces. And on this, he's been pretty vague.
Karen Nussbaum, again, from the European perspective, perhaps the German, do they see the United States as having been ineffective in countering ISIS during the Obama years? It's clearly grown. Is there a sense of anticipation of some big change in policy, that if some a switch were flipped, we could do things in a substantively, substantially different way with better outcome?
Well, if you're looking at the politicians in Germany, I think that today, for example, it was revealed that Turkey, in the opinion of the German foreign ministry, has been growing as a base for ISIS and for Islamic radicalization much more strongly than they had let the mm-hmm. public know. So in terms of the United States becoming more of an effective fighter against ISIS, I think there's always the notion that the United States are actually asking Europeans to do more, to participate more than the European voters really want them to engage with. Germany has had quite a history of opposing their own participation in a fight against ISIS. But I think the hope is there that Hillary Clinton will find a much more diplomatic way and more effective way than perhaps even President Obama has been able to pursue. But that, once again, Trump is the person with radical solutions who don't understand what both David and Holly have mentioned, that it is very complicated, and that there is a history behind the growth of ISIS that perhaps Donald Trump doesn't understand, but the hope is much more there that Hillary Clinton will provide more diplomatic solutions and more viable solutions for European politicians to, in a way, save face also as their own elections are coming up.
Though Hillary Clinton, of course, has a reputation as being more hawkish than Barack Obama. We'll look at what that might mean. Let's go to our listeners, Andy in Charleston, South Carolina. Andy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When it came to Mr. Trump, I believe 100% in the content of his message. Maybe his delivery is a little rough, but I believe he's correct as far as the vetting. Let's make sure the people we bring here are not ideologically opposed to our way of living and our common beliefs. I also think that our allies should have more of a dog in the fight instead of us carrying the load financially and with our own blood. And that's all I had to say, sir.
I appreciate your call, Andy. Thank you very much. Let's get one more right here, and we'll look at it. Terrence in Omaha, Nebraska.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have just a couple points about Trump's speech. He talks about working with the allies and defeating ISIS, but he's also talked about a mob-style NATO, like making them pay for defense. So I'm wondering what allies are going to work with us if he becomes president. And another point, he says this is his foreign policy now. Well, it might change since it's already changed 3 or 4 times. So just wondering, how truth is this?
Where's it end up? There has been change. And, of course, there was that big letter from 50 Republican national security experts who came out and said, no way, no how are they going with Donald Trump. But here he is. David Sanger, you can imagine Americans looking around the world and saying, certainly, as Donald Trump describes it, it's a dark and scary place, and thinking this Obama way hasn't worked. We want something different here. And for allies, he's saying, well, maybe he'll get some new ones. Maybe he'll work with Moscow.
Well, a couple points here. First of all, there's nothing wrong with having evolving foreign policy positions. If you're a candidate who's new to this, I mean, Donald Trump is 70 years old. He's been a real estate developer most of his adult life. He hasn't had to think about foreign policy strategy, and there's no reason to think that his first blush impressions that he gave in earlier speeches and the interviews with us or other places wouldn't, evolve over time. And I think it's good that they have, because it means he's beginning to get some advice, he's giving us some deeper thought, and particularly on the immigration area, he is now, I think, recognized that a test that is based purely on religious belief, it does not comport with what America is all about, and certainly what our Constitution would suggest or our tradition since. On the second point, which is the nature of the vetting, which your first caller went through, it's all a question of how that's designed. I mean, obviously, there's an extremely detailed vetting system already. Ask anybody who has tried to get into the country or get a visa into the country from a foreign nation that's involved in a lot of these conflicts. Even are former translators in Iraq and Afghanistan, mm-hmm. who were promised by the U.S. military that we'd take care of them, have spent years trying to get to the United States when they are under considerable peril. So the system right now, I bet they would tell you, is pretty extreme. Legally, I think the question is, how do you design this? And practically, how do you get somebody to explain their own ideological views? And we've seen immigrants who think that America is a great dream come here and then react against the freedom, the free expression, the free religion, the social media. And so their reaction once they arrive after a few years is very different from when they were coming in. And you've seen some of the attacks have gone on from people who became radicalized after they were in the United States, some born in the United States. So this is a very difficult thing to try to sort out at the border unless you shut down everything, and that's not the story of America.
And, of course, if they're coming with ill intent, why would they lay that out when they answered questions at the border? So it's tricky. Peter in Boston, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Listen, I think that finally, I'm not at all a supporter of Hillary, and I had some major problems with Trump, but I mean, I think now he's at least starting to focus, and it just shows, it's just a stark contrast. Hillary is a continuation of Obama. Absolutely not much is going to change the way she looks at it. I think that Trump's finally articulating something that sounds reasonable, Islamic militants, and starting to do something that we really need to check and do this vetting. I mean, and it's a much more reasonable, nuanced approach to the situation. Again, there's just something, Merkel being cited, I think Merkel's got major problems. I mean, she opened the green light for this, and about 2 million Muslims have crossed over into, and what has happened over there now? I think Merkel will be lucky to get reelected. I mean, the dissatisfaction with Germany and the other people who originally thought that this was going to be a piece of cake taking in, and they didn't think the ramifications. I'm hoping that doesn't happen to us in America, that we need to really vet strongly, particularly, again, he's focusing on Trump, on the need, Islamic terror, and possibly setting up other areas to help protect these people, but not to allow them in mass until we can get this vetting done.
Not to bring them here. Peter, I appreciate your call. I'm trying to square these, Ali Tusi. I mean, on the one hand, some people are going to listen here and say, well, maybe there's some merit in there. On the other hand, you've got these Republican national security people saying that he lacks the character, the values, the experience, little understanding of national interests, diplomatic challenges, indispensable alliances, democratic values. Can you have some good ideas and still be so thoroughly discounted by the people in this national security sort of regime of the party you're running with?
Well, sure. And one of the things, let's look at one aspect of it, right? So David was right in saying that Trump has evolved to some extent, and maybe that's a good thing for someone who doesn't have a lot of foreign policy experience. But there's a difference between evolution and contradiction. And if you look at Trump's speech alone yesterday, and this is something a lot of Republicans in the national security realm complain about, he contradicts himself at times. He, for instance, praises Egypt and Jordan and Israel as strong partners in this fight against Islamic terrorism. At the same time, he says he wants to suspend immigration from regions that are affected by terrorism. And that would include the Middle East. So are you going to tell the country of Egypt, we're not going to let your citizens come visit America anymore, but by the way, we want you to cooperate with us on everything we're doing against battling Islamic terrorism? There's issues of diplomatic sensitivities, political sensitivities, and these types of things do matter. And so when you have these Republicans come out and say, look, this guy just does not know how to deal with something so complex, and we're worried he's going to make the situation worse, you can understand somewhat where they're coming from when you look at some of these contradictions.
They may be contradictions. Our caller right there saying, well, we don't want the same thing we've had for 4 years. Even if it's contradictory, some people with a hunger for a change. And Donald Trump looking to speak to that in Ohio yesterday. Leaders on national security in his own party writing, none of us will vote for Donald Trump. And Hillary Clinton saying he'll blow up alliances and put us in worse shape. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton on American foreign policy, one of them very likely to guide the way of the world, the way in the world of the United States, come Inauguration Day next year. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in the Trump approach to foreign policy? What about Hillary Clinton and her view of the world and how it works? Whose hand, whose instincts do you want guiding the ship of state on foreign policy? David Sanger joins us this hour, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Nahal Halitoussi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Karen Osman, she's Washington correspondent for the German news magazine show Spiegel TV. Donald Trump saying he would strictly control immigration, alleging Hillary Clinton might welcome hundreds of thousands of more immigrants, refugees into the country, likened her to Germany's chancellor.
Hillary Clinton wants to be America's Angela Merkel. And you know what a disaster this massive immigration has been to Germany and the people of Germany. Crime has risen to levels that no one thought they would ever, ever see. It is a catastrophe.
Of course, Angela Merkel brought in a million or so refugees and more. Hillary Clinton has not put numbers like that out there. So far, the American intake has been very small. Clinton, this was at a speech in Stanford in March, focused on standing by allies and warned that if Trump gets closer with the Kremlin, that will not be good for the United States. Here she was.
Turning our back on our alliances or turning our alliance into a protection racket would reverse decades of bipartisan American leadership and send a dangerous signal to friend and foe alike. Putin already hopes to divide Europe. If Mr. Trump gets his way, it'll be like Christmas in the Kremlin. It will make America less safe and the world more dangerous.
Halitoussi, what do you see in his warmer attitude toward Russia and the notion of an alliance with Russia to take on ISIS?
Well, first of all, I'm trying to just kind of envision what Christmas with Vladimir Putin would be like.
Yeah.
And I think I'd like to witness that, actually. It is very striking, Trump's fondness for Putin and the Russian style of things. But I think it's also worth noting that the U.S., although our relations with Russia are chilly, especially over topics like Ukraine and Syria, we do cooperate with them to some extent and are trying to cooperate with them. When it comes to Syria in particular, we're trying to coordinate airstrikes against ISIS with the Russians right now in Syria. And so it's one of those things where Trump's big point that we should deal with the Kremlin more, that we should try to work with them, is not necessarily something that the Obama administration can say, well, we would never do that. But this idea that maybe Trump would say, well, we're not going to stand up to Russia if, say, he were to threaten the Baltics or take other steps, or he might, you know, or just basically look away if Russia were to do more to back separatists in Ukraine. I think that's where Clinton and others would draw the line, because they feel like Russia definitely could prove a threat to Europe and thus to NATO and thus to this alliance that they believe has kept this world a much safer place for decades.
David Sanger, do you see Donald Trump's way of describing relations with Russia as just a repackaging of what's going on already when John Kerry tries to coordinate with them in Syria? Or do you see something fundamentally different? I mean, people look at his campaign leader there, Paul Manafort, and these reports about how he received millions from the Russian-backed leader of Ukraine. I mean, more than 12 million, something like that, and wonder what's going on here. Do you see a substantially different notion of this relationship in the Trump depiction?
Well, there may well be. He hasn't been highly specific, but in the interviews that we did and the speeches he's given, he has not defined an area where he would stand up to Putin and say, this is something you can't do. When we asked him in the interview in Cleveland in July what he would do if Russia attacked one of the three former Soviet states that are now new members of NATO, Estonia, Lithuania, Latvia, he said he'd check first and see how much they contributed to NATO, which is a very different conception of the alliance than the one that has existed for the past 70 years. There's a fundamental difference that the United States and Russia have about the future of Syria, where the U.S. has said that Bashar al-Assad, Syria's president, was killed by some estimates nearly 400,000 people since the civil war began 5 years ago, cannot stay. And the Russians have indicated that while they're not completely tied to him, they certainly want somebody like him there. And the Iranians said they are tied to him. So in the speech, you didn't hear an unkind word yesterday about Assad, even though he has killed hundreds of thousands. You heard praise for Mubarak, who the former president of Egypt, who President Obama had urged to leave office, and Donald Trump believes that was a mistake. During the attempted coup in Turkey, you heard praise for President Erdogan, an American ally, but certainly a strong man. And in the speech, you heard praise for President Sisi, another American ally who has not been criticized by Obama, but has certainly done everything he could to jail the Muslim Brotherhood and other opponents. So you get a sense that Mr. Trump has an appreciation for strongman leaders who will take matters into their own hands in defeating terrorism. And Mr. Trump said to us on several occasions that he did not believe it was the role of the United States to meddle inside other nations' countries, lecture to them about, say, human rights. So, yes, I think it would be a very different approach.
I mean, Karen Osmond, it can sound like turning things right upside down. The U.S. under George Bush, certainly nation building and a lot of talk about democracy building. The U.S. Forever, basically, putting itself out there as a beacon of freedom and democracy. Donald Trump talking about, well, forget nation building. And he seems quite comfortable dealing, as David Sanger says, with strongmen, even dictators. Is this a hyper-pragmatic, never mind ideology at all view of the world?
I think it's what came to mind when I was listening to speech yesterday was that he's really talking like a businessman, right? Like he is the CEO of the United States, and his foreign policy is let's just get rid of all the old lousy contracts and start all over again. So when David talks about his preferring strongman leaders, I think it's because he envisions himself sort of as the top executive sitting at the head of the boardroom and canceling everything and starting from scratch and you know duking it out in the boardroom. I do want to make one point though that mm-hmm. I feel I need to address about what Donald Trump has been saying about the catastrophe of the refugee crisis in Germany. And I don't see many people really questioning whether it's really such a big catastrophe. I think politically it's very difficult for Merkel because of the election cycle coming up next year. Mm-hmm. And I think once the economy in Germany suffers and that relationship can be made between the refugees and any kind of economic issues that she has, then she's going to have a real problem. But I would like to really push back a little bit against this idea that you enter Germany and you have refugees just flying in your face begging or doing, you know, like that's just not at all the reality of the situation in Germany right now. And I think we need to push back against these claims that he makes that it's been such a dreadful catastrophe.
I mean, at some level, perhaps Merkel is at the hardest part right now, that Germany is digesting this large inflow. You say the economy may turn down. I guess it could go the other way as well. They may successfully, after this time of political friction, absorb and move forward with a new population.
Absolutely. And that was one of the reasons, one of many reasons, why Merkel, I believe, and a lot of politicians in Germany were open to admitting so many refugees, because there's a population issue. You know, we have pensions.
Aging population.
You know, now there's talk that Germans will have to work until 69 before they can get their... until they're 69 before they can get their Social Security benefits. So there's definitely a problem with working population that is paying taxes and paying into our Social Security system.
And, of course, this inflow has been of relatively young people. Vice President Joe Biden out on the campaign trail yesterday for the first time with Hillary Clinton in this season and going hard after Donald Trump on foreign policy, said Trump would have loved Joseph Stalin, Biden said, that his words endanger the lives of U.S. troops overseas, said that he was leaving after a speech for Kosovo and Serbia and the Baltic states to reassure NATO countries that America would stick with its allies no matter what Donald Trump had said. Here's Biden.
Because they're worried. Listen to his comments about Ukraine. He assures us Russia will not move on Ukraine. Without understanding, they've already moved on Ukraine and occupy Crimea. This guy's shame has no limits. He's even gone so far as to ask Putin and Russia to conduct cyber attacks against the United States of America.
Joe Biden slugging there for Hillary Clinton yesterday. Jose in Marietta, Georgia. Jose, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Trump whipping out the teleprompter yesterday and reading from it had all the aplomb of a high school student reading back a prepared speech on why he should be class president. And the simplified response from the live audience, his live audience, showed how hard it is for them to absorb his big thought strategies as opposed to his usual soundbite solutions on how to say.
I mean, it's hard to knock a guy for reading from a teleprompter when things get serious. Presidents do that.
But that's not his style.
No, it's not his. It's not his go-to style. I mean, he seemed way off his go-to style yesterday. But it's hard to knock a guy from reading from a teleprompter when the issues are serious. And yet, he did go off the teleprompter. I mean, the extreme vetting line, as far as I can see, David Sanger was not in the prepared text of this, or even in the transcript that the campaign released after the speech.
No, the extreme vetting was, or what he called extreme vetting.
Yes, double.
Was part of his extemporaneous remarks, and I thought that was sort of interesting. It's not unusual for him. He likes to, you know, overstate, and then when you try to ask for an explanation of what exactly that means, it's unclear. But, you know, the lack of clarity is on both sides here. I mean, let me give you another example we haven't really focused on. Hillary Clinton argued for a much more aggressive American response in Syria during the time that she was Secretary of State. She wasn't alone in that. David Petraeus, then the head of the CIA, also argued for arming the rebels.
Yep.
Since that time, since she left office, the situation has gotten vastly more complicated because a number of the things that we could have done, create safe zones, put up air cover, bomb the runways so that Assad couldn't launch his planes that have been dropping barrel bombs, is much more complex because of the Russian intervention in the war. And as I said at the beginning of the show, now their intervention from Iranian territory.
Yeah.
So a lot of the options she argued for aren't there now. But we haven't heard from her what she would go do of a more aggressive nature in Syria under these circumstances.
Leaving a kind of ambiguity around her position as well. At this point, we know what it was. What is it now? I mean, she's really gone hard after is Trump himself and this issue of trust. And
That's right. And we wrote a little bit about that last week when we, Bill Broad and I wrote about, you know, can a president actually launch a nuclear weapon by himself with no checks and balances? Turns out the answer is by and large, yes. But with a few caveats.
And Trump has said, why not use nukes against ISIS, hasn't he?
Well, I have not heard him say that. We have heard reports that he has said that. He certainly hasn't said that in any of the interviews I've been involved in. In fact, he said, if anything, he would be quite cautious with nuclear weapons. But I don't know if he said that to others. We've never been able to quite track that down.
Hillary Clinton going with the trust issue in her speech at the Democratic convention.
Imagine him in the Oval Office facing a real crisis. A man you can bait with a tweet is not a man we can trust with nuclear weapons.
Holly Tusey, Americans are asked to make this choice. What do you make of the fact that, again, all these Republicans, 50, the most senior Republican national security officials saying none of us will vote for Donald Trump?
that he's just got the wrong character for it. And Hillary Clinton jumping on that as well. How does a voter assess that? If they may feel unhappy with the way things are going in the world, they may want a change, and then you get security officials saying, well, even Republicans saying, not this guy. How's a voter supposed to put that together or move toward a change if they want it?
Well, a couple of points here. First of all, when you have 50 GOP national security experts slash leaders attacking Trump, to some extent, it actually feeds into his political narrative, which is, look, I am not the establishment. I am an outsider, and these guys don't know what they're doing, and I'm going to append the order in Washington, D.C. So to a certain stretch of voters, this is actually a very good thing. Oh, man, these guys don't like Trump, therefore I will like him more. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The other thing is what I find really fascinating about a lot of this, especially when it comes to Clinton. And I asked a Clinton advisor this the other day. I said, why isn't she laying out more details about her plans, especially when it comes to Syria and some of the things that she wants to do? And he said, well, why should she? Trump has all the attention. Why not just focus it all on Trump? And, you know, why should she go out there and make herself more of a target by giving specifics when you have this other person taking up all the media oxygen with everything from some of his more outlandish statements to even some of these speeches that will draw criticism no matter what. So on a political level, you have this very interesting dynamic where Clinton, there are so many things we still need to know about what she plans to do, but she's just not getting the coverage and she doesn't necessarily seeking it out either.
David Sanger, 30 seconds before we wrap here. Does that mean voters should think, well, in that case, I look forward to kind of an extension of the Obama approach under Hillary Clinton?
You know, I think by and large you're going to see an extension, but I think there are areas with North Korea, Syria, and others where she's expressed more hawkish views. Let's hope that during the debates or any interviews she does between now and then, that we actually learn a lot more about how she views the world today versus how she viewed it when she was secretary.
That's going to be something to see, something to hear. David Sanger, national security correspondent with the New York Times. Terrific to have you with us today. Thanks very much, David, for joining us.
Thank you.
With us there via Skype from Weston, Vermont, Karen Osman with Spiegel TV, joining us today from Washington, Washington correspondent. Karen, thank you very much for your insights.
Thanks for having me.
And Holly Tusi, foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Holly, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your input as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.